You. I have her bio in front of me this time, just didn't have the schedule. Nancy White is an authority on construction law and business law. She completed research in the areas of ethics and dispute resolution and is now working with the Central Michigan Dispute Resolution Center, which mediates conflicts at local, regional, or state levels in the areas of personal, business, or domestic disputes. She's conducted research about dispute resolution in other countries, most notably Korea. Her most recent research interest is on the search for Native American justice through the law, its current status, and historical development. So with that, I give you Nancy.
Thank you very much. Actually, my main interest in business has always been business ethics, and so that's kind of what drew me into nanotechnology, and especially in construction ethics. I thought it was kind of interesting that the main difference between ethics at the construction site and in the nanotechnology field, it's just a matter of size, but it's actually the same issue. Basically, what I have to tell you is one if by land and two if by sea and three if by airplane, the government is coming, the government is coming, the government is coming. Basically, any technology such as a new technology like this one that has some kind of dramatic social implication, there's going to be a demand for a certain amount of regulation. Now, actually, in society in general, I think people are actually expecting nanotechnology or some type of technology to save them from these problems such as water and energy. And so I don't think we'll have this same type of social cry out that we have had for some of the other types of technologies, as long as nanotechnology doesn't get too involved too quickly in DNA research. I don't think we'll have the same problems with nanotechnology that we do with other biotechnologies. However, there is a principle in international law called the precautionary principle, and to the extent that international law has any effect on any government, there is this particular principle, and it does require governments to actually look at situations before getting into them, and to if there is a potentially hazardous activity, then the government has a burden to look at its harm to humans and ecosystems, to evaluate the effects where needed. The government needs to take some kind of action to avoid potential threats. And also, the precautionary principle does require that things be open and transparent, which is actually certainly a very good thing. There's four possible regulatory responses to nanotechnology. These are the basic four: prohibition, permissible use only in the military, moderate regulation, and laissez-faire. I've put these three on this slide because I don't think that these are the ones that the federal government is going to take. But I'll just put them here just to be complete. First would be prohibition. And as I said, I don't think there's going to be any prohibition of nanotechnology, perhaps certain areas of nanotechnology, if it were to get into gene manipulation or something like that. But as far as water, energy, that kind of thing, I don't see any kind of prohibition from the government. Military use only, again, although I think nanotechnology is going to be extensively used in the military, it's not going to be limited by our government to just the military. And the bottom one is laissez-faire, that is no regulation. So far, we haven't seen very much regulation in nanotechnology, but it is growing. What we're going to actually see is modest regulation. And in order to determine what is going to happen in nanotechnology, it's always a good idea to look at the recent past. And the biotech has generally been considered a fairly successful regulatory scheme. So you can take a look at biotech and see what's happened there. And there will be a similar type of situation in nanotechnology. Some of the major things that are going to be looked at by the government, I'm sure, will be the limitation of self-replicating systems, the possible use of encryption for any types of software that perhaps could be used to decrease use by terrorists and that kind of thing. And then, of course, health and environmental research. Once nanotechnology does begin to produce wealth, special interest groups are going to start influencing policy. So now is the time to plan. And For example, the Foresight Institute, their policies will probably be used by the federal government because generally the federal government's going to start with what's already there and is going to look at policies that are in place and go from there. So any pre-planning that's done in a forum such as this is going to be used by the federal government, so certainly should be continued. This is an overview. I'm going to talk about just a little bit about these certain areas of the law, which right now has some impact that these areas of the law on nanotechnology. And I'll talk about each one of them just a little. I think that some of the, there's another panel, for example, on intellectual property, so I won't talk about it very much, but I'll just make a few comments. These are the federal agencies that are involved with the Nanotechnology Research and Development Act, and so one can expect to see regulations coming from all of these agencies to somehow impact nanotechnology research. Basically, one of the big players is going to be the Environmental Protection Agency, and they have some grants for research into environmental impact of nanotechnology. Last summer in June, there was a public meeting to discuss the potential voluntary pilot program by the industry and the Environmental Protection Agency. The program seemed to go very well. There was a lot of support for a voluntary pilot program, and I would suspect that voluntary programs in this area would be more common than intensive government regulation. There is support for developing standardization in nomenclature and standards of care, and also some quick action and some increased health and safety research. One of the reasons I don't see a large amount of government regulation, particularly at this time, is that overregulation actually does tend to produce under-administration. You can take a look at OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and see some of the regulations there. For example, the regulation of toxins in the environment. The OSHA has promulgated very strict regulations on toxins. However, because of the strictness of the regulations, the enforcement is extremely difficult, costly, and timely, and so they've actually only put a few toxins on their list of toxic materials. And so therefore, even though the regulations are fairly detailed, there aren't very many toxins that are actually being regulated. And in addition, there is some understanding, the idea that actually new technology tends to be a little bit safer perhaps than old technology. So why do we want to prevent new technology? We want to actually encourage it. Of course, it's politically much easier to regulate any kind of new technology rather than old technology. But I think there is an understanding at the government level that this is not something that we want to do, that we have major problems that nanotechnology can address, and so therefore the government's going to want to actually encourage nanotechnology research. However, there are some environmental concerns relating to nanotechnology. Will the materials be biodegradable? Can they be made biodegradable? I saw a little video clip yesterday from someone who did a presentation, and there was like a little nano machine that was going through the bloodstream, and it ate like a bacteria or something, and it, you know, kind of pooped out some water and carbon dioxide or something. I don't know. Can we do that? Can there be some way that we can make these nanoparticles biodegradable or somehow, you know, reduce them to water and carbon dioxide or something? What about entrance into the food chain? What happens if some of these particles start getting into the food chain? How will the nanomaterials enter the environment? How will they change it? How can we dispose of nanomaterial litter, either in the production or perhaps at the end, things are no longer being used? How are we going to dispose of nanomaterial litter? Nanolitter is an interesting word there. How might nanomaterials get into plants and organisms, and then do we need any limitations on exposure to certain nanoproducts? Presently in effect, and has been around for a long time, about 30 years, is the Toxic Substances Control Act, and basically, while it doesn't really deal specifically with nanoproducts and nanomaterials, certainly the language of the act is broad enough to cover any type of nanomaterial, it basically says that anyone who manufactures a chemical substance or mixture, whatever that is, and who obtains information which reasonably supports the conclusion that such substance or mixture presents substantial risk of injury or health to the environment, must inform the EPA. So therefore, if you have any kind of information, you need to report it to the EPA. If anybody's sitting out there, I happen to have their address here if you need to contact them quickly. The advantage to informing the EPA in advance is that the fines, et cetera, are much less. The EPA generally works with you. If they find out that you have put some kind of a toxic chemical into the environment, then you're not going to be a very happy camper. The Act also gives the EPA power to and the authority to require that manufacturers or processors of chemical substances develop new data. So I think that we can expect to see some regulation coming out of the EPA fairly soon regarding requirements for health risk testing and environmental testing coming out of the EPA fairly soon, especially since during the summer they said that quick action needed to be taken. I'm pretty sure that that's probably going to happen fairly soon. There's a 90-day advance notice of intent to manufacture or import any kind of a new chemical substance not listed on the EPA's TSCA inventory. Now, some people might want to argue that, well, a nano something or other isn't a chemical. I wouldn't want to be a company that's making that argument, because I think that it would probably, the EPA would take the stand that it's covered under the Toxic Substances Control Act, and it would be up to you to then litigate it through the system that it's not. And my guess is that you wouldn't be very successful in such a claim. The next major player is going to be the Food and Drug Administration, and they will regulate any nanoparticles, nanosubstances that are ingested or placed that are ingested into the human body or placed on the skin. They have some interesting definitions of devices, drugs. I would say, again, that all of these, that nanoparticles, nanotypes of materials could fall under the existing definitions. And so it's not as if someone can escape by saying, well, there's no regulation of nanoparticles, I don't have to worry about it. I'd say that the existing law and the existing regulations are going to cover nanoparticles, and so therefore you want to be very careful if you're going to produce anything that's going to be ingested by humans. Make sure you go through the Food and Drug Administration requirements. There is going to be problems with classification, although I don't think the problems are so much going to be external. I think the Food and Drug Administration is going to say any nanoparticle that is ingested or placed on the skin is subject to Food and Drug Administration regulation. Actually, the problem is going to be more internal in the FDA, which section, department, who's going to handle what. It's fairly complicated there on who handles devices, who handles drugs, and nanoparticles may fall into different people's areas of expertise, and so there may be some internal Food and Drug Administration problems because of that. Another problem the Food and Drug Administration feels they have is that is maintaining expertise. They don't have enough expertise in nanomaterials, et cetera, and so that could cause delays in any kind of FDA approval. Next, and like I said, I'll just talk a little bit about the Patent Office since there is going to be another panel on this. Basically, to be patentable, an invention must be novel, useful, and non-obvious. Pure miniaturizations are not considered patentable. However, there is something called the doctrine of equivalence, and this basically says that if an invention performs the same or a similar function in a substantially different way, it is not an infringement. And so for this reason, probably many of the nano machines or nano ways of doing things would not be an infringement of an existing patent, because they do it in such a new and novel way. Of course, patents are difficult to protect. They're fairly expensive to prepare, but they're extremely expensive to enforce. Another alternative might be trade secrets. A trade secret, basically, the advantage of a trade secret is that it has unlimited life. If you can keep it a secret, it can be a trade secret forever. One of the most effective trade secrets on the planet is the formulation for Coca-Cola. It's been kept a secret for about 100 years now, and so therefore it remains the property of Coca-Cola. However, it is very difficult to put policies and measures into place to keep your trade secrets. And since a lot of nanotechnology is being done in colleges and universities and in an academic setting, the openness of academia does not usually lead to trade secret protection. Another area I think that's going to possibly impact nanotechnology is the fact that the government has a license. If the nanotechnology has been developed in an academic setting with government money, this particular amendment to the Patent Act says that the government retains a royalty-free license to any patented technology. And I think this might be used later if there's some type of a problem with patents not being used, companies using warehousing patents, et cetera, then the government may come in and just issue and just license patents that it has an interest in to competing companies. Another area of patent law is that one must be careful when using other people's technology, even at an experimental level. This particular case basically said that the experimental use defense doesn't really exist. While you may be able to experiment in your garage with someone else's patent, you can't experiment with someone else's patent in your own laboratory and develop something different from it. The government's going to want to prevent warehousing of patents. Back in the 20s when radio was invented, and also I think it was in the 50s with AT&T, there were a lot of problems with patents being warehoused or staying in conglomerating into particular companies. The patents weren't being used. The technology wasn't getting out there. The government's not going to want this to happen, and so therefore the government's going to want to make sure that if there are patents out there, that they're actually going to be used and improve life. The public funding agencies, therefore, that fund the research into nanotechnology could place restrictions on patents that either the university has or the people who work for the university have. And so you could expect some type of regulation in that area to make sure that the patents are used and are not being warehoused. Also, in order to keep the transparency open, it's likely that the government's going to want to have information banks to give public notice of any exclusive licenses of publicly funded patents, because the public's going to want to make sure that, hey, we paid for this funding, we paid for this research into nanotech, it should be used for public benefit and not just to make business wealthy. The average person, I would say, is not particularly thrilled with business at the present time. There's been a lot of scandals, and so to some extent, the average person in the U.S. is going to be a little bit leery of business. And so by having these kinds of things transparent, open, everybody knows what's going on, that's going to allay the suspicions of the average person and allow for businesses to actually make profits and benefit society through the use of these patents. The Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, their concern is going to be antitrust concerns. They're going to want to make sure that the markets are competitive. They may regulate mergers of companies that have patents. In the early stages, it's likely that mergers will be easier to have because there will be patents spread all over. However, the government's going to want to make sure that the markets remain competitive and are not going to want to have all of the patents to remain in one particular company. And so, therefore, there may be some problems with mergers and acquisitions. Next is the Department of Agriculture. This is an international trade issue. Basically, the Department of Agriculture oversees compliance with the SPS agreement, which is the sanitary and phytosanitary measures of the World Trade Organization. It deals with the World Trade Organization in this area. And basically, it's an agreement applicable to member countries who may refuse to import something for health or safety reasons. And so the Department of Agriculture will tend to look into that. The recent example has been the one about the U.S. beef. the World Trade Organization decided that Europe's refusal to import U.S. beef that had been given hormones-enhanced feed was in violation of the WTO. It's likely that these kinds of issues may arise also with nanotechnology issues, too, that different countries may not want to import products that have nanotechnology involved in them some way. Property law and related criminal law. If a piece of property can be constructed from inexpensive materials almost anywhere, the instructions, of course, for making the object will be very valuable, but the object itself will not. This could have some profound effects on our criminal law and our property law, as the particular item that you own may not be particularly valuable. It's just the instructions. And since much of our criminal law is based upon property and property rights, it could be that maybe we'll have much reduced crime in the future related to nanotechnology. Next, the government's probably going to be more involved in biological weapons conventions and chemical weapons conventions, because these two particular conventions don't really deal with nanotechnology. And while, as compared to the EPA and the FDA definitions, which probably do include nanotechnology and nanoparticles, the biological weapons conventions and the chemical weapons conventions probably don't cover nanotechnology, nanoparticles, and so it's likely that the government or governments in the world will get together, and there'll be some clamor to have some additional international treaties relating to nanotechnology and on the same lines as the biological weapons convention and the chemical weapons convention. We can expect to see some new nano weapons conventions. Future trends, I expect to see basically demands and research in the health and environmental effects. I think the government will actually have voluntary programs. Voluntary programs have proved very useful in the Toxic Substances Control Act and also in OSHA. There's been, for example, in the Toxic Control Act, there's been approximately 15,000 reports of releases of toxic substances, and it's proved to be very workable between the government and voluntary business actually voluntarily getting involved with the cleanup and that kind of thing. The government's going to want to prevent warehousing, and there's also going to be antitrust implications relating to the patents. And the government's going to want to make sure that the technology is exploited, not that it's warehoused. You might see some profound changes in fundamental property and criminal law in the far distant future, but not something we probably have to worry about right now. Okay, do we have any questions?
Hi.
Hi. You'd started off by mentioning the precautionary principle as part of international law.
Right.
What international law is it part of, and did the U.S. actually sign it?
International law is kind of an oxymoron to a lawyer. It depends on your definition of law. My definition of law is a standard of behavior enforced by a government. And since most international laws are not enforced by any government, are they really laws? But for example, historically, there's something called the law of conquest. There was the discovery doctrine that gave us all the land to all the Indians. That was the principle of international law. International law in that area is just, it's kind of almost like an ethical determination by countries. I don't even know where it comes from. People look out there and they say, it is no longer acceptable to, like in Roman times, it was acceptable to go and attack some state or country and kill everybody and take all their property. Law of conquest, international law said it's okay. Now it's not okay.
Right, but we actually have treaties that say that sort of thing, and, right, and countries sign on to them. Has any country signed on to the precautionary principle as a treaty?
Not that I know of. I think it's still something that is, yeah, no, I don't think okay. It's in any treaties.
Yeah, I think there's significant disagreement about it.
Oh, I think so, too.
I have a couple of questions for you. One is,
whether you think FDA might act, I'm over here, whether FDA might act on consumer products regarding nanotechnology, and also down the line in the future, whether you think the current regulations as they stand being divided among OSHA, EPA, FDA, that will remain in place, or there might be a new institution that would deal with nanomaterials.
I think there'll probably be a new institution in the not too distant future. But yes, I think that the chemistry, the technology is so different that the FDA and the EPA don't quite mesh. OSHA, very different. So I think there'll be probably a separate governmental agency. But in the near term, I don't think that the EPA is going to allow or the FDA is going to allow distribution of products without some kind of regulatory oversight.
Just on the precautionary principle thing. Hi, I'm over here. Recently, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled on a case where the precautionary principle was accepted as a valid test, which, of course, has the Supreme Court of Canada, therefore, has legal force in Canada, and it acts as a precedent for anyone in the British Commonwealth, so under the British common law. So that's one case where that has come forward and has been accepted as a meritorious proposal.
Right. I think one of the things that's going to happen is we're going to hopefully get away from just having government regulation. As long as business and industry can self-regulate, then I think that's going to be very important in this area. We're not going to have to follow, we're not going to have cases and judges ruling in this kind of area. We're going to have more involvement by business.
Sure. With you. You talked about Bayh-Dole, and one thing that I didn't hear was a part of Bayh-Dole, I think, that says that if you use U.S. government research money to do the research, then you must manufacture in the U.S. unless there are some waivers given or something like that. Is that still the case, and do you see any change coming in that?
As far as I know, there hasn't been any change, but I'd have to check on that. Right.
And it's not that I'm unaware.
Right. Right. No, I don't know of any. Someone else might know, but I don't think there's been any change in that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to take a break now. We are just about on schedule, so please go have some coffee and cookies and brownies and whatever gives you some energy for later this afternoon. If you're a poster presenter, please make sure that you get your poster up pretty quickly.